A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's got a friend who's going through a rough stretch mentally, and he's caught in that tension between wanting to be supportive and knowing he's not a therapist. He says he's reluctant to give advice. His instinct is to suggest professional help, but he doesn't want to seem like he's brushing the person off. And he's asking two things. How do you actually be helpful without overstepping? And how do you honestly say, I don't have the bandwidth right now, without tanking the friendship?
This is one of those questions where the fact that someone's even asking it tells you they're probably already doing better than most people. But the mechanics of it, the actual scripts, the research on what works, that's where it gets interesting. Because most of us were handed exactly zero training on this, and then expected to just figure it out.
You're a good person, now go improvise someone else's mental health care model.
And the numbers on why this matters right now are pretty stark. The CDC's data from early this year shows 41% of adults reported anxiety or depression symptoms in the past year. That's not a fringe experience. That's nearly every other person you know. So if you're listening to this and thinking, I don't have a friend in this situation, statistically, you probably do, you just might not know it yet.
41%. That's less a statistic and more a description of the water we're all swimming in.
And the prompt gets at something really honest that most advice columns dance around, which is that reluctance. I want to be empathetic, but if asked for advice, I'm always reluctant to give it. That's not coldness. That's actually a pretty sophisticated read of the situation. Untrained advice in a mental health context can do real harm.
Let's unpack what's really going on here. Because this isn't just about one conversation. It's about a whole skill set most of us were never taught. And the core tension is this. You want to be a good friend, but you also know you're not a licensed professional, and those two things feel like they're in conflict. They're not. But figuring out where the line is takes some work.
I think the first thing to name is that feeling guilty about recommending professional help is completely backwards. If your friend had a persistent cough that wasn't going away, you wouldn't feel like a bad friend for suggesting they see a doctor. You'd feel like a bad friend if you didn't. But with mental health, we've got this cultural hangover where suggesting therapy somehow means you're rejecting the person or saying their problems aren't real enough for friendship.
The subtext people hear is, your problems are now above my pay grade. Please take them elsewhere. Which, to be fair, is sometimes exactly what's being communicated, just dressed up in nicer language.
That's the thing. The research on peer support is actually surprisingly clear about what works and what doesn't. Let's start with the mechanics of effective support. There was a big meta-analysis in The Lancet Psychiatry back in 2023 that looked at structured peer support programs across multiple countries. The findings were pretty striking. Peer support reduced hospitalization rates by 18% and significantly improved recovery outcomes. But, and this is the part everyone skips, the effect only held when the boundaries and roles were clear.
It's not that non-professional support doesn't work. It's that it works when everyone knows what it is and what it isn't.
And the analysis defined peer support as something very specific. It's not venting sessions. It's not, let me tell you what I think you should do. It's structured, reciprocal, and grounded in shared lived experience. The most effective models had trained peer supporters who understood both the value and the limits of what they were offering.
Which is a long way from, my friend is texting me at midnight and I don't know what to say.
Right, but the principles scale down, and this is where the research on types of support gets really useful. There's a framework that divides peer support into three buckets. First is emotional validation. That's listening without fixing, just being present with someone's experience. Second is practical assistance, rides to appointments, dropping off a meal, helping with paperwork. Third is informational guidance, helping someone navigate resources, understand their options, figure out what kind of help exists.
Most people, especially the kind of people who listen to this show, default straight to bucket three. Here's what you should do. Have you considered cognitive behavioral therapy? Let me tell you about the difference between SSRIs and SNRIs.
Because that's what we're good at, We're informational people, but the research consistently shows that when someone's in crisis, what they actually need first is bucket one, just emotional validation. I hear you. This sounds really hard. I'm here.
The thing you can't Google your way out of.
There's a really elegant piece of communication research that came out of Georgetown's linguistics department a few years back on what they call ask versus guess culture. The idea is that some people are askers. They're comfortable making direct requests. They don't take it personally if you say no. And some people are guessers. They hint, they leave openings, they feel extremely uncomfortable making direct requests because they don't want to impose.
Oh, this explains so much about every awkward social interaction I've ever had.
It really does. And in a mental health support context, the mismatch can be brutal. An asker friend says, "Can you come over right now? I'm struggling." A guesser friend says, "It's fine, I'll manage, don't worry about me," and then feels abandoned when you take them at their word. Meanwhile, if you're an asker trying to support a guesser, your direct offers, "Can I bring you dinner tonight?" might feel like pressure. And if you're a guesser supporting an asker, your open-ended, "Let me know if you need anything," might feel like a brush-off.
The one-size-fits-all advice of, "Just reach out and offer specific help," which is everywhere, by the way. Every wellness Instagram account has this in their carousel that actually only works for about half the population.
The fix isn't complicated, it's just specific. You ask the person what kind of communication works for them. When you're having a hard time, do you prefer direct offers or do you like to be the one to reach out? It's a 30-second conversation that prevents months of miscommunication.
That's almost annoyingly simple.
The best communication frameworks usually are. And this connects directly to one of the most common failure points in these situations, which is the "have you tried therapy" conversation. The prompt mentions that the instinct is to recommend professional help, and that instinct is correct, but the delivery matters enormously.
Because you should see a therapist can land as, "I'm done listening to you."
There's a power dynamic baked into that phrasing. "You should" is prescriptive. It positions the speaker as the one who knows what's best and the listener as someone who needs to be directed. Even when that's not the intent, it's what lands. The alternative that the research supports is an exploratory approach. Instead of "you should see a therapist," it's "what kind of support have you found helpful before?" Or "is professional help something you've considered?" Or even just "it sounds like you're carrying a lot. Have you thought about what kind of support might help?"
The difference is, you're not handing them a solution. You're helping them think through their own options.
That matters because one of the core principles from developmental psychology that maps really well onto peer support is the concept of scaffolding. The idea is, you provide just enough support to keep the structure stable, but not so much that you're taking over the construction. The person's agency remains central. When you say you should see a therapist, you've taken over. When you say, "have you thought about what kind of support might help," you're reinforcing the scaffolding.
Let's make this concrete. Someone texts you, "I'm having a really bad day." What's the evidence-based response?
The single best thing you can do is give them control over what kind of support they need in that moment. The line that keeps showing up in the research is some version of, "I'm sorry you're going through that. Do you want to talk about it, or would distraction help more?"
That's it?
That's it. You've validated. "I'm sorry you're going through that," and you've offered a choice that puts them in the driver's seat. Talk or distract. Two completely different kinds of support, and you're letting them tell you which one they need.
As opposed to what most of us do, which is immediately launch into problem-solving mode. "Have you tried exercise? What about meditation? My cousin swears by cold plunges."
Which is well-intentioned, but it's actually about reducing our own discomfort. We don't like sitting with someone else's pain, so we try to fix it. The research on this is pretty humbling. Unsolicited advice, even when it's good advice, often makes the person feel worse because it communicates, "Your distress is a problem I need to solve and move past."
The emotional equivalent of someone trying to fix your computer while you're still trying to tell them what's wrong with it.
That's exactly the right analogy. And there's a case study I keep coming back to on this. A friend calls and says they're struggling. The listener's instinct is to offer solutions. "Here's what I think you should do." But the evidence-based response is to slow down, validate, and ask what kind of support they need. The research from NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, consistently emphasizes that the most effective peer support starts with listening, not advising. Their whole framework is built around the idea that the person experiencing the crisis is the expert on their own experience.
Which is a hard thing to internalize when you're the kind of person who reads research papers for fun and has opinions about everything.
I feel personally attacked. Even the best support strategies fall apart if we don't address the elephant in the room. What happens when we're the ones who need a break? And this is the second half of the prompt, and honestly, I think it's the harder half. How do you say, I can't be your therapist without ending the friendship?
Because the fear is real. You set a boundary and the person hears you're too much. And for someone who's already struggling, that confirmation of their worst fear, that they're a burden, can be devastating.
There was a study published in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships last year that put some numbers on this. They found that 67% of people who withdrew from a struggling friend did so not because they didn't care, but because they felt overwhelmed and didn't know how to communicate their limits. They ghosted, basically, because the alternative, saying, I'm at capacity, felt too hard.
Two-thirds of friendship casualties in these situations aren't about lack of care. They're about lack of communication skills.
That's tragic because the skills are learnable. The first thing to understand is the difference between what researchers call compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma. Compassion fatigue is the gradual erosion of your ability to care. It's the emotional exhaustion that comes from sustained exposure to someone else's suffering. Vicarious trauma is more acute. It's when you start to internalize the other person's distress to the point where it affects your own worldview and sense of safety.
Neither of those is a character flaw. They're predictable consequences of being human and caring about someone who's in pain.
Framing it that way is essential because it takes the moral judgment out of it. You're not a bad person for hitting your limit. You're a person with a nervous system that has finite capacity. The question is, what you do when you feel that limit approaching?
Give me the script. What do you actually say?
The key principle is that you name your limit while affirming the relationship. The worst version is, I can't deal with this right now. That's pure rejection. The better version is something like, I care about you and I want to be here for you, but I'm not in a place right now where I can give this the attention it deserves. Can we check in tomorrow?
The difference is, you're not saying you're too much. You're saying my capacity is limited right now, and I want to show up well for you, so let me do it when I can actually be present.
And notice the structure. You open with care. I care about you. You state your limit in terms of your own capacity, not their behavior. I'm not in a place right now. You reinforce that you want to be there. I want to give this the attention it deserves. And you offer a specific alternative. Can we check in tomorrow? That last piece is crucial. A vague let's talk later feels like a brush off. A specific timeline feels like a commitment.
What about the late night caller? The friend who consistently reaches out at 11 p.m. when you're already exhausted.
This is the case study that comes up constantly. A friend calls every night to vent. The listener is running on fumes, dreading the phone, starting to resent the person. The script here needs to name the pattern without blame. Something like, I love you and I want to be there for you, but I've noticed these late night calls are leaving me drained and I'm not able to show up well for you. Can we set a regular check-in time on Tuesdays and Thursdays instead?
The structure is the same. Care, capacity, alternative. But the thing I notice is, you're not saying you're calling too much. You're saying the current arrangement isn't working for me. Let's build something sustainable.
That's the reframe that saves friendships. You're not rejecting the person. You're rejecting the unsustainable structure and proposing a better one. The research on this from the peer support literature is really consistent. The relationships that last are the ones where boundaries are explicit and mutually understood. The ones that burn out are the ones where one person silently accumulates resentment until they disappear.
The ghost doesn't hate you. The ghost just never learned how to say, I'm at 40% and dropping.
That gets to a deeper point about what researchers call the circle of support model. The idea is that no single person should ever be the sole support for someone in crisis. It's not sustainable for the supporter, and it's not healthy for the person who's struggling either, because it concentrates all the risk in one relationship.
Part of being a good friend is actively helping the person build a wider net.
And the research from NAMI and Mental Health First Aid both emphasize this, helping someone identify 3 to 5 people or resources they can rotate through. A therapist, a family member, a support group, a crisis hotline, another friend. The goal is distribution. And the conversation about it can be collaborative rather than deflective. I can help you look for therapists if that feels overwhelming. Would you like me to sit with you while you call your insurance? Let's make a list together of who else you could reach out to when things get hard.
You're not saying please call someone else. You're saying let's build a system so you're never dependent on one person, including me.
That's actually more caring, not less. It's the difference between giving someone a fish and helping them build a fishing network. But there's a harder version of this conversation, and I think we need to go there. What do you say when you're genuinely worried about someone's safety? When it's moved past bad day into, I'm not sure this person is going to be okay.
The red flag conversation.
The framework here is about escalation, not abandonment. The key red flags are suicidal ideation, self-harm, inability to function for multiple days, can't get out of bed, not eating, not showing up for basic responsibilities. In those situations, I'm here for you is not enough. And the script shifts from what kind of support do you need to, I'm worried about you, and I think we need to get someone with more training involved.
The we is doing a lot of work there.
It's doing all the work. I think you need help is abandonment. I think we need to get someone with more training involved is partnership. You're not handing them off, you're walking with them toward the next level of care.
What if they push back? What if they say, I don't need a therapist, I just need you to listen?
This is where it gets hard, and I think honesty is the only thing that works. Something like, I hear you, and I want to keep being here for you. But I'm also realizing that what you're going through is bigger than what I know how to help with, and I don't want to pretend I'm equipped for this when I'm not. That wouldn't be fair to either of us.
You're naming your limitation as a limitation, not as a rejection. I don't know how to help with this is very different from, I don't want to help.
For some people, that lands. For others, they get angry or hurt, and you have to be prepared for that. The research on boundary setting in close relationships is pretty clear that the initial reaction is not the final reaction. People often push back, feel rejected, get defensive, and then, days or weeks later, come around. The boundary holds even if the immediate response is negative.
The advice is, set the boundary, tolerate the discomfort, and don't immediately walk it back just because the person is upset.
That's the hardest part. Because if you're the kind of person who's attracted to supporting others, you probably hate being the source of someone's pain. The instinct to apologize and overcorrect is strong. But collapsing your boundary to make someone feel better in the moment just guarantees a bigger rupture later.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that's the analogy I'd choose, but the principle stands.
Let's pull all of this together into something you can actually use starting today. What are the walkaway scripts?
Three things I'd want every listener to have in their pocket. First, before you offer any support, ask the question that prevents 80% of mismatched support attempts. Do you want me to listen, help, or distract? Gives them control. Instantly clarifies what kind of conversation this is going to be.
Listen, help, or distract. That's clean.
Second, set boundaries early and explicitly. Don't wait until you're resentful. If you've got 20 minutes, say, I can talk for 20 minutes. If you can help research therapists this weekend, say, I can help you research therapists this weekend. The specificity is the kindness. Vague availability creates expectations you can't meet. Build a support map with your friend, a written list of 3 to 5 people and resources they can rotate through, therapist, hotline, family member, support group, another friend. It's a concrete artifact that says, you're not alone and I'm not your only option. And the act of making it together reinforces that you're on the same team.
For the listener who's sitting there thinking, I need to do this, but I don't know where to start. What's the one thing they can do this week?
Two things, actually. First, practice one boundary-setting script in a low-stakes conversation. Not with the friend in crisis, with someone where the stakes are lower. Say, I can talk for 15 minutes, or I'm not in a place to discuss this right now. Can we pick it up tomorrow? Get comfortable with the words before you need them in a hard conversation.
Build the muscle before you need to lift heavy.
And second, identify one friend you can check in on using the listen, help, or distract question. Not necessarily the person who's visibly struggling, just someone you haven't connected with in a while. These skills aren't just for crisis. They're for being a better human in general.
I think there's a bigger structural question underneath all of this that's worth sitting with. The prompt is fundamentally about an individual relationship, me and my struggling friend. But the reason so many people feel unequipped for these conversations is that we've concentrated mental health support onto a tiny number of professionals and then expected everyone else to just figure it out on their own.
The professionalization of care has had this weird side effect where people think if they're not a therapist, they have nothing to offer. And the research says the opposite. Peer support works. It measurably improves outcomes. But it works when people are trained, when boundaries are clear, when the support is structured.
Maybe the question isn't just, how do I support my friend? It's how do we build communities where mental health support is distributed, rather than concentrated on a few professionals and the exhausted friends who happen to be nearby?
The landscape is shifting in ways that make this question more urgent. Just this month, the FDI approved a new AI-assisted crisis response platform. Teletherapy has exploded. The tools for professional support are getting more accessible, but that also means the role of friends is changing. We're not the crisis managers anymore, or we shouldn't be. We're more like support navigators, helping people find the right professional resource rather than trying to provide the support ourselves.
The friend is routing layer.
Which sounds cold until you realize it's actually more sustainable for everyone. The friend who burns out and disappears helps no one. The friend who knows their limits, communicates them clearly, and helps navigate toward professional resources. That person can show up for years.
The final thought is this. Being a good friend doesn't mean being a therapist. It means knowing the difference and having the courage to say, I'm here, but I'm not enough, and that's okay.
I think the prompt gets at something really honest that most people won't admit. That reluctance to give advice? That's not a failure of friendship. That's actually a pretty sophisticated recognition of the limits of what one person can do for another. The question is, what you do with that recognition? Do you disappear because you can't fix it? Or do you stay with clear boundaries and help build a system that can actually hold the person?
The difference between running away and standing at the edge of what you can do and saying, this is as far as I go, but I'll help you find the next person who can take you further.
That's not abandonment. That's love with clarity.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, naturalists in the Faroe Islands documented that naked mole rats produce vocalizations at frequencies above 20 kHz, well into the ultrasonic range, meaning their social chatter is completely inaudible to the human ear. Entire colonies could be having heated arguments right next to you and you'd never know.
Naked mole rats are basically running encrypted group chats.
I have so many follow-up questions that I'm not sure I want answered.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop, and if you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.